Welcome, folks, to the one of the last sessions of the TechEd event this year in North America. Truly appreciate you spending time with us. It's almost time for the party at Universal Studios, so it's all good. What's that? Okay. So my name is Subbu Chandrasekharan. I'm a program manager with the Business Link Business Voice team. And a little bit about myself, I've been with the team doing various components over the years, from devices to media infrastructure to the voice components. And it's a pleasure to have Mr. R-Man with me during the session. This is none other than the Rui Maximo. And we're going to be, hopefully it's going to be a very interactive session, and Rui is going to help me kind of make this session lively.
Thanks for inviting me, Subbu.
Absolutely. My pleasure. All right. So a quick skim through the agenda, and I'll tell you why it was actually organized this way. First is let's do a quick review of high-level link topology and what changes we've made, especially focused on enterprise voice. And then we kind of move on to how do you actually plan for enterprise voice specific features that typically are considered pretty critical. And we flow into the reference architecture, high availability and resiliency, which hopefully will give you a good idea on this is what I really need. And we jump into the interoperability principle, which of course apparently seems to be a pretty hot topic, talking to most of you folks on the floor, and it seems pretty critical to you folks. And we'll specifically jump into some of the user scenarios and how we can configure Link to enable IP-PBX interoperability scenarios. And in this session, we'll specifically take Cisco as an example. And finally, we'll talk a little bit about video interoperability. Although voice seems to be the most popular and most of the questions that I get is related to voice, video definitely is going to be pretty critical once the voice payload has been taken care of.
So, Subbu, this is all about voice then. Enterprise voice, is that what we're covering here?
Yes. Primarily, it's all going to be about enterprise voice, and that's why we kind of have video interop. It's important to some of the folks. Just a quick show of hands. How many of you folks are interested in knowing more about voice interoperability? Okay, that's great. Actually, that's good. So the content is still going to be fairly useful. Okay. So two takeaways we definitely want to want you folks to walk out with. One is have a really clear understanding on this is the reference architecture that relates to me from a link perspective. Let's assume your PBX doesn't exist as of today. If I were to deploy Link, this is the approach that I want to take. So that's takeaway number one. Takeaway number two is obviously you have an IP-PBX, which most of you folks do, and how can I enable Link and then have it coexist with the IP-PBX that I currently have, plan for migration across one another, and of course, needless to say, interoperability. All right, so let's jump right in.
So Subbu, that looks like pretty complicated, right? That's all Link in there. What parts of those servers are related to voice?
Okay, great. So, you know, one of our colleagues would say, you know, when such questions come in, I'm glad you asked, you know. So let's just focus on components that are related only to enterprise voice. So I've highlighted in red boxes right here. So rather than sort of going through all the components that Link has to offer, just look at the voice-related components. The biggest change that has happened, most of you obviously know, is the mediation server is now etched into the front-end server. Now, what that means is whenever you set up a front-end server, mediation server doesn't actually have to be enabled or installed or whatever. It just comes with it. And this is what we recommend in most of the topology that you're going to see. And there are cases when that is not going to be true. And that's why a mediation server can also be added into the topology as a standalone role. And a classic example of that is going to be when you have SIP trunks, right? And we'll talk about why that is so, but if you have SIP trunks, the recommendation is definitely have mediation server as a standalone. From a scalability perspective and also from a performance of your front end, it definitely helps to have a standalone mediation server for SIPTrunk. Quick show of hands, how many of you folks currently are planning or already have SIPTrunk? Okay, quite a few. Excellent. IP PBX, clearly, we're going to talk about it. That's important for enterprise voice. Media Gateway and SBA. SBA, most of you folks know about it. We'll talk a little bit more about it as well. SBA is Survivable Branch Appliances, and it provides you survivability when you have flaky WAN connections. Analog devices, you already would have your own analog device lying around your company, and Link definitely offers a solution where the analog devices can also be managed and then have them tracked through our CDRs. Exchange UM, last but not the least, of course, I do not know of any voice deployment without a voicemail. Exchange UM is our voicemail component. And definitely that is part of our voice solution. Now, we'll quickly look at the voice resiliency architecture. So let's take a simple case right here. We have a data center, and there is a pool, of course, and let's call it EE Pool 1. And we have Bob as a user, and whose primary pool is the EE Pool. Because this is the pool that Bob is homed into. Let's say we have another pool, EE Pool 2, and it could be in a different location altogether, or it could be in the same geographic location. Let's assume Alice is homed here, and the primary pool for Alice is EE Pool 2. Now, in order for us to be able to provide resiliency, specifically voice resiliency, each of these pools could be configured as backup of one another. So what that means is, should EE pool go down, the users originally homed in EE pool 1 would automatically sign into EE pool 2. And then what that provides is a voice resiliency, right? And that means in this particular case, Bob is able to sign into EE pool 2 and then have the voice functionality turned on automatically.
So does that mean like only voice, or do you still have presence and contacts and
That's
conferencing?
Right. So as you can see, it says Bob's primary registrar and user services, right? The user services is a component that actually provides you presence, contact, and nodes and groups and stuff. From a resiliency perspective, what's available is your voice and you're able to sign in, and the presence is not available automatically. Okay. When during the resiliency mode, when there is limited functionality, that isn't.
So you have the ability to make calls, basically.
Yes, exactly. So whenever we talk about voice and resiliency and survivability, the bottom line is really you got to be able to sign in and then have voice functionality no matter what, and that's precisely what this offers. And this isn't limited to just larger locations, right? You're also talking about branch locations where it's a smaller site, you have smaller group of users. And potentially you have a survivable branch appliance. And we'll talk a little bit more about what survivable branch appliance is, but let's assume there is a simplified version of an equipment that enables users in the branch office to be able to sign in. They would be able to make voice calls and then presence, contacts, and full-blown functionality. But there could be a situation when the branch appliance could go down as well. So automatically what happens is anytime there is a branch appliance configured, it is automatically associated to a mothership, if you will. It has to be associated to a full-blown pool. So should the branch appliance fail, then the user is automatically signed on to the backup registrar. In this particular case, it could be the EE pool.
So that's assuming that the WAN link is still up. And
that is assuming the WAN link is still up. We're also going to look at situations when the WAN link is down. Okay. But for now, the point is you're still able to sign in into your backup registrar, which is going to be your EE pool at this point in time.
So what happens when the, in this case, the survival branch appliance comes back up? Do the users automatically reconnect to the primary registrar?
Okay, again, I'm glad you asked. yes, that's correct. So what happens is there is always heartbeats going on between the branch appliance and the EE pool, or the pool that the appliance is associated to. And the period, I believe, is about 5 to 10 minutes. And once the branch appliance is back up, and the client automatically is going to try its primary registrar. When it is available, yes, it does.
And so it'll automatically re-register with the primary registrar.
That is correct. So there great. There would be a ramp up.
So then at that point, you'll get all the functionality that's available in Link.
That is correct. Okay.
So you're going to cover features. These are voice-related features?
All these are voice-related features. We did have another session on Tuesday that covered voice-related features. So I did not want to have an overlap of those features again. So what I'm going to do is I'll focus on features that weren't covered, but of course, in the larger scheme of things, hopefully it's an aggregation of what was covered during the Tuesday session and what we're going to cover here. And that'll set context to how we design our reference architecture for Link.
Great.
Okay, location and enhanced E911. All right. So E911 is, of course, obviously enhanced 911. It uses what's called as LIS, Location Information Server. What it is it's a web service that accesses location information database, which contains a mapping between location-specific information such as your street address, city zip code, and which goes on at a very granular level, to network elements or network information. So in the order of preference, how it actually maps a specific location to the network elements would be your BSSID, the LLDP ports that are currently configured in your network, ports and switches, of course, subnet, and finally, MAC address. So if MAC address is available and there is mapping to your location, yes, so that information can be available.
So it's basically E911 is the ability to actually automatically send the user's presence
that
to
is
the
correct.
First responder, right?
That is correct. So it actually serves two purposes. So we use this rich location information, one, for enhanced 911 should emergency occur. You're actually able to send very specific information to the dispatch center. And also in presence, right? So if this functionality is enabled, a user signs in and the presence and the location information is automatically published.
Published, okay.
So as in, let's say you visit Building 30 back in Redmond sometime, and your presence would actually indicate that.
Okay.
Because that information is dynamically fetched based on where your current endpoint is.
Based on probably your subnets, right?
That is correct. So it could be based on various other things, but of course, the subnet is something that we also do. We also use BSSID back in Microsoft as well. Now, so as we saw, the location information, the LIS service provides rich location information, but it's not just enough for you to pull off enhanced 911 because you want to be very careful in what route you want to go when emergency occurs, right? You want to hit the right gateway. So I typically work off of Redmond. But if I visit Los Angeles, I want to make sure I actually hit the closest dispatch center, right? So we want the system to be intelligent to actually determine that. Hmm. And the way it actually gets done is by using location policy. Location policy is, it actually provides two things, right? The routing information basically it contains the routing information and also the emergency call number. So if I'm in North America, I'm actually getting 911 because that's the emergency call. And it's based on two things. One is the user, and the other one is what subnet I'm currently located in. And the reason I say user is because every user is assigned a default location policy. Let's say for some reason I can't map my subnet to a location policy, I would use my default location policy.
So policies can be assigned at the user level. You said there was a default level.
Correct.
Can you assign it at the pool level in certain subnets, or what are the
levels
of granularity?
Yeah, so we're going to cover that, so hold on to that. Okay, so E911, just to quickly close on this, has to be provided. So we have to sign up with a service provider. And it also provides us an ability to do instant messaging with the security and also do conferencing should there be an emergency call session going on. And outside of the United States, where E911 is not available, no problem. We can still do location-based routing, which again takes into consideration where your current endpoint is, and then it hits the right gateway and not based on where you are currently homed in.
Right.
Because you could be homed in a different location but signed in from a different.
So I understand E911 is only available in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not available in other countries?
That is correct. Yeah. So, I mean, of course, it's an ongoing effort.
Right.
So right now...
It's not available outside the United States.
That's correct. So the next functionality is voice routing and trunk translation. And this is actually a great value because Link definitely allows you to have failover routes. Hopefully you folks are familiar with the least cost routing. So just to give you a quick example of what that is, let's say I'm a Redmond user, I want to place a PSTN call to London number,
yeah,
right? So I want to minimize my telephone bill, and I can configure my route to make sure majority of my media passes through the WAN link of my company, and then it just egresses through the closest gateway of the number I'm trying to reach.
So if your company had a gateway in London,
yes,
then the call could egress out of the London,
absolutely,
London gateway.
And that's the whole idea.
That's
right?
Great. So, yeah. As opposed to egressing here in the United States, doing a transatlantic.
Yeah, which is obviously going to incur a lot more cost than if you were to egress through London. So in this particular example, so what this feature actually essentially allows you to do is based on what gateway you egress off of, it allows you to format the number so that it's appropriate. If it's an international call, then you can configure the trunk to format the number accordingly. In this example, let's take Alice calling London number, and on top of the list, least cost routing has been configured. Of course, look at the one at the bottom because it's kind of flipped in this example.
So the bottom one is where the call is egressing from the London gateway.
Correct. So the bottom one is the one that's actually egressing through the London gateway. And as you can see, the number format is different, which actually reflects it were to egress through the London gateway.
Right.
And for some reason, if the gateway is down, Link allows you to have backup routes.
Okay.
So in this case, let's say I just don't bother. My default gateway is going to be Redmond. Should the primary fail, then the formatting is going to be different.
And you can see the formatting is international calling
that
number, 011. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, as you can see. I mean, I'm sure you folks can see that. Right there.
Right.
All right. So caller ID presentation control. And again, this is a pretty useful feature from two perspectives. One is privacy. The other one is for security. So what this allows you to do is to be able to configure a trunk to mask the caller ID and not really reveal the original caller. So in this particular example, let's say Alice is making an external PSTN call, and Alice's original number is 425-707-9050. And if it hits an external PSTN number, the trunk can be configured to mask it to a common number. So in this particular case, it's a Microsoft common number. And at no point in time would the internal numbers be revealed.
So I have a little joke. I heard that everybody in Redmond, when they go to Safeway or QFC, you know how they have that option to put in the phone number?
Right.
Everybody puts 882-8080.
That's good, right? So everybody gets to have the same, you know, the preferred
number. Yeah, because they don't want to put their own personal phone number.
Oh, that's why people keep calling me by different names, apparently. So that could be it. So Alice, when the call is placed to an internal PBX number, of course, it's not masked. So one interesting scenario is if simultaneous ring is enabled in this particular example, let's say Bob calls Alice, and Alice is set up simultaneous ringing, and when the number actually hits Alice's cellular phone, the number will not be masked. So the reason is if the call was actually intended for a user that is internal to the company, there is no need to mask a number. In this particular case, Alice already knows Bob. There is no need to
right,
mask
because they're internal calls.
Correct. And one other level of granularity is you can control the masking by PSTN usages. So it doesn't actually have to apply to a trunk so you can specifically select the PSTN usages that you want to apply the mask to. Okay, Exchange Unified Messaging. Yes, it is the only supported voicemail solution, at least from an out-of-the-box perspective. That is the only solution that's available. And anything that's above, newer than Exchange 2007 SP1 is supported. And there's been two very popular questions. One is does it make sense to co-locate a link server with unified messaging? The answer to that is no. And especially if the Exchange servers are connected to the link through a WAN. Because the simple reason being, the connectivity between the unified messaging and the Exchange server, if it has to traverse through WAN, it's very, very, it's so not tolerant to latency from a MAPI traffic perspective.
So it sounds like it's better to co-locate the Exchange UM server with the Exchange mailbox.
That is correct. So you want to actually always have the Exchange servers together and then separate out link, because the VoIP calls across between link and Exchange, that just does just fine. Okay. Just because of all the healing capabilities.
So does that mean that, like, if I'm calling you and you don't pick up the call, uh-huh, and the call gets routed to voicemail, mm-hmm, does the actual media, which is going to be network heavy, is that going to traverse through the link server to the Exchange server, or can it go directly to the Exchange server?
It really depends on if it's a VoIP call, then obviously it's just going to go directly between your link endpoint and your Exchange server. If it's a PSTN, obviously it's going to flow through the mediation server.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And the other question is, can the unified messaging and link exist across different forests? The answer to that is yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And just to ensure that some of the UM settings for the user object have to be replicated across to the link forest, and then you should be covered there. And one more question that keeps coming up is, what if some of my users sign up for Exchange Online and some of them are still in Exchange On-Prem? Is it supported? Yes, again, yes. That mix is supported, absolutely. And there are procedures that actually that needs to be followed, especially with some of the attributes for the user object that needs to be set. This one's specifically for Exchange UM enablement for voicemail.
Okay.
And there are PowerShell scripts available, and the recommendation is do it during when the user is being moved from on-prem to online, so it can be part of the same workflow.
So you got to know here, why is the Exchange the Edge server required to be
deployed? Okay. So the reason why it is required is, one is when you actually connect into the online world, it's no problem because that's already covered. But there are some scenarios such as playback, right? So when the connection has to be established from the cloud back to the on-prem, and it has to traverse through, obviously, you've got to find a way to find
the
your
user
way
into
the... Yes, exactly.
Got it.
So that's the...
So the media traverses through the Edge server?
Yes.
The access...
correct.
The Edge server.
That is correct. Yes. No, this is when the user is the link on-prem. The user is still in the on-premise network, and everything UM and Exchange is all online. Correct. So the question, go ahead.
Yeah,
so there are scenarios when you have to reach out into the cloud, and there are scenarios when things like playback, right? So when the media connectivity has to be established from the cloud into the endpoint itself, right? So that way you have to find a way to traverse yourself back into the network, into the company's network. And I don't want to go into the rest of the features because we already covered it, but the point is I just want to make sure these are things that you want to keep in mind. We've already seen what's new. And in addition to that, we have response group, call park server, private line, call controls like forwarding, simul ring transfer, delegate team call, announcement servers, unassigned numbers, common area phones, last but not the least, call admission control. The point is, these gamut of features should basically cover all your enterprise voice deployment, right? And with this in mind, and with the understanding, and we shall go into the next section, which should hopefully, when we are done with this section, you should be comfortable with the first takeaway bullet point, which is to be comfortable or have a good understanding of the reference architecture that's going to be appropriate in your case. Okay, so in Link 2010, we've done a lot of work to simplify the topology pretty significantly. No, from the editions of the server, there's just two, right? Standard edition and enterprise edition. Standard edition is just out-of-the-box experience. It's just one box that provides all the functionalities. It could be a presence, instant messaging, voice, conferencing, application sharing, data collaboration, monitoring, archiving, you name it, you got it, right? One thing to keep in mind is it's very specific. I mean, there are situations when standard edition is great. For out-of-the-box, we'll look at it shortly. But it's great for out-of-the-box experience. It's really super fast ramp-up. Enterprise edition, it needs more expertise. However, it is super plastic. You can basically design your topology the way you want it, and this provides a great flexibility. We'll also look into that shortly.
And it provides more scalability, right?
Yeah, absolutely. These are, you know, various factors that Enterprise Edition is going to help you with. Yes, absolutely. So servers would be the front end. Yes, these are absolutely needed. This is the heart of the whole system. It provides you with the core registrar, conferencing, data collab, archiving, and all the good stuff. Backend, this is the backend store that stores user data that's real-time as well as persistent data. AV conferencing, there are situations when AV conferencing would be a separate pool. We'll look at when that is applicable. And edge server, yes. Obviously, people do want external access. Edge is an absolute must. These are the two servers that are external and that we rely on. UM, Exchange UM for voicemail, and SCOM for alerting and monitoring. When I say monitoring, I meant from purely from an alerting perspective.
For the services?
For the services, the various components. Optional servers, mediation server. There are situations when mediation server is needed. A good example would be SIPTrunk. That is our recommendation. Group chat continues to be a separate pool, and again, it is optional. Archiving and monitoring, depending on the scale that you want to achieve, it is not an absolute necessity, but when you're talking about a bigger scale and when you want to deploy a separate database just for monitoring and archiving, yes, there is an option to put them separately. And director is very interesting. So again, it is a recommendation when there is the deployment itself is super large. And the main functionality of the director is this, right? It lets the user know what the home user is. During the discovery process, as well as when a request is being issued from outside the network and the request gets in through the access proxy. And the director is the director, typically the first hop from the edge server, proxies the SIP request accordingly.
So you probably want to deploy the director if you have multiple pools, right?
That is correct. Yeah. So
that's where it really comes into play.
That's
a
really good point. Because, like I said, the only goal in director's life is this, right? I want to help people find where the request has to finally land it. If there's multiple pools and if there are lots of discovery going on and if lots of proxying requests that's coming in, then it's an additional load on the existing EE pool because they also have to serve the existing registered servers. Maybe there's like, you know, conferencing going on. Maybe, you know, the mediation server is really transcoding in there because obviously the front-end pools are busy all the time, right? So from a performance standpoint, having directors, especially for an expanded deployment, makes total sense. Okay. So let's talk about the deployment model, and that's going to address the question that you had.
All right.
Right? So from an administrative perspective, we've always found that they want to look at a deployment model from an end-user perspective. And traditionally, how the end-users have been managed is they want a layered and hierarchical approach, right? And especially, it comes handy, especially when policies has to be applied, things like group policy. And you don't want to be applying policies to every user, but you basically want to be chunking the users. Chunking the users. That way, you create multiple levels of hierarchy, essentially. Right. Now, we have taken the same approach with a link a deployment model as well. So starting from global, what that means is when we say global, it's the entire deployment. So any time something is applied globally, it applies to all the servers, every component, right?
And it's by default. So if a component or a user does not have a policy, it automatically gets a default.
Exactly. So when we start talking about policy, yes, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what happens. And then there is this concept of central site. So global, and then that contains central site. Central site kind of maps to your geographic location. So just to give you an example, Microsoft has three central sites, one in North America. As you can see, one of the examples, it's in Tukwila. Which is a suburb of Seattle. One in Dublin and one in Singapore. So these are like broader central sites, and those are going to take care of each of these regions. And central sites contain pools. So one central site can contain many number of pools. And there could be multiple reasons why you want many pools. Rather than having really large pools, you can split the large pool in two and then have one as the backup of another. And there are other reasons why you want to do that too. So central sites contain pools. Pools contain?
Users.
Exactly. I mean, you could say servers, but it doesn't really matter, right? Because it's a single unit.
Right.
But contains users. So that is exactly how we do policy management. So various levels are user level, pool level, site level, and global.
Global.
And that makes it very easy for the administrator, too.
So I heard that a good practice recommendation is to restrict your global policy the most so that if you hadn't accounted for something, that user or that pool or that central site would automatically acquire that default policy.
Correct.
And then you start opening up or lessening the restrictions as you go further down,
right.
So that you know what's happening. Would that be a good policy to do, or a good
practice? That would be a good policy to do, but also depends on how granular you want the control to be.
Sure.
I would say site would be a good one because from a geopolitical standpoint, certain things are acceptable, certain things aren't.
Right.
So site would probably be kind of reflective of what that region's general policy would be.
Cool.
And then you can drill down further. Okay, this is how we'll be doing on time, so 42. Okay. Deployment options, right? This is a pretty busy slide. I apologize for that. But what I would like you folks to take a look at is right at the top, right? So that kind of gives you an idea what's appropriate for you. If it's a smaller trial deployment, the choice is pretty obvious. Just go with the standard edition server. And a typical use would be just it's a departmental deployment, or you're just basically trying out something that's not critical, trial out, piloting. That would be good.
Or a smaller organization.
Or right? A smaller organization, yeah. Absolutely. And then if you're kind of feeling like a bigger boy where, you want to support pool level resiliency, let's say my server goes down and then I still want to make sure my services are available, then the choice would be to elevate yourself to Enterprise Edition pool. That means you're going to have multiple servers in a pool, and typically with the first one where it's a small deployment, we haven't seen too many branch deployment happen. But the second flavor, which is the green, would be a good candidate to try out the branch scenarios as well. This could be in the form of having a PSTN in your branch, or actually even having a branch survivability model in the form of an appliance. And then finally, when you're like feeling like the king of the world, where you want to support multiple site resiliency, then you do multiple pools within a site, as well as you have EE pools across various sites as well. And of course, branch is also kind of interesting in this particular case. And one thing that is kind of interesting, I don't want to dwell too deep into this because we're going to look at these things in the reference architecture diagrams. What if you actually want resiliency when you have SE edition, right? You don't want to take
the standard edition? Yeah, I was going to ask you that. So, I mean, standard edition obviously doesn't have the resiliency that
Right. So one of the options as highlighted in this particular case is to just pair two standard edition servers. So that way, if one dies, you can always fail over to the other one. The service is still available.
This is the backup registrar?
That will be the backup registrar for the paired standard editions. Okay, so let me go on I'm going to cover branch office shortly, so I'm just going to hold on to that one.
I think it's the next slide. Oh, no.
Not yet. Okay, the first reference architecture is, let's say you have a deployment that has only 5,000 users or up to 5,000 users, right? Well, I promise it's going to be fairly simple. So in this particular case, as you can see, there is one standard edition server. If you want branch survivability, that brings you to the second server, right? But if that's not so critical, that's pretty optional. However, I would assume the external access is also continuing to be important. So in which case, with three servers, you're actually able to serve about 5,000 users. So that's good. I mean, it's fairly straightforward, simple.
And that's with all the workloads, IAM, conferencing?
Everything that you can think of. Correct. So let's say you're elevated to supporting 20,000 users. What are we looking at? So the recommendation is to have an EE pool, clearly, because for one, you have to be able to scale, and 20,000 users is a lot of users to take. I mean, you really can't risk it, right? So you definitely want redundancy in this particular case. So you have a director pool that, again, has redundancy, plus an edge pool with redundancy, of course. I'm sorry.
Now, how many front-end servers would you need in order to support 100,000 users?
Okay, so if you without our AV conferencing, we can support up to 10,000 users per node, right?
Front-end.
Correct. So, but to answer your question, we support up to 8 front-ends in a pool. So our recommendation is basically, in your case, if it's 10,000, it's probably 2 pools with 6 front-ends and 4 front-ends in the other one. So that would take you to 10,000.
Got it. 100,000, right?
I'm sorry, 100,000, yes, 6 and 4. AV conferencing, that's, again, optional. And to the point that I just mentioned, right, if your scale requirement per node is 10,000, then our recommendation is to go with a separate audio-video conferencing pool. If it is somewhere in the ballpark of, 5,000 to 7,500, then you should just be fine with using AV conferencing as part of the EE pool itself. All right, so it's happening again.
Thunderstorm.
Okay, so in this, so the monitoring pool is also optional, and as you can see, it's sharing its backend database with the EE pool itself. And if you want branch appliance, yes, that's great. If you want branch survivability, that's an option. And as you can see, branch 2 does not have any form of link deployment there. The reason being, maybe it has a reliable WAN connectivity. So it doesn't actually warrant a separate link role in there. So let me finish this slide, and then I'll open it up for questions if you folks have. So don't let this slide actually scare you. The point of this slide is to show the possibility of how much you can extend, okay? So one other question that I also get is, I'm supporting 20,000 users and I need 14 servers. That seems like too excessive, right?
Yeah.
But this is kind of a foundation that you're going to lay. If you think about what is it going to take me to support 30,000 users, what is it going to take? It's just one more,
yeah.
Right? And 40,000... So 30,000 would be 15 servers, 40,000 would be 16 servers, and so on and on. So fundamentally, it's you're basically setting up a foundation, and then anytime you want to increase it, it kind of extends itself kind of seamlessly.
It's an incremental deployment.
Correct. So this is obviously a sort of like a bulletproof site right here. The front-end pool is obviously much larger, and it has AV pool monitoring. The only thing I would like to call out in here is the monitoring and the archiving pool has its own separate database. And when the scale of the database requirement goes up, the recommendation is to have its own database. And clearly, other sites can be added to the topology as well. Adding other EE pools. And in the case you might want to have a new link deployment, but not support as many users, have an SE pool as well. So you can absolutely have a combination of EE pools and SE pools.
So if you have a branch office that's fairly large, and you have maybe 1,000 users in there, then you could deploy a standard edition?
Yes. That's a great question. So with survivable branch appliance, so let me cover that, and then I'll come to your question shortly, okay? And how many of you folks are already familiar with survivable branch appliance and what it does? Okay, so a few of you folks. So I'll quickly spend some time so that it's for the benefit of folks that don't know, right? So we talk about survivable branch appliance, but what it really is, it's a purpose-built appliance that whose only purpose in life is to make sure the branch office users have survivability, voice survivability. When it comes to enterprise voice survivability, only two things matter, right? You got to be signed in, and you got to be able to make phone calls no matter what. And that's exactly what Survivable Branch Appliance does. And the reason it's an appliance is, of course, it's an out-of-the-box experience. There is an easy workflow to kind of deploy it. And also, there is a wide choice of SBAs that's available that we work with OEM partners with.
Now, so basically, an SBA has, it's what, a registrar plus a gateway?
Good question. So, like I said, for you to be able to support voice and registration, you need a registrar, obviously. You need the application that does outbound and inbound routing. So that application already exists. And then when you have to interface with the PSTN, because voice, you have to be able to connect to the PSTN cloud, you need the mediation server component. So essentially, it's a registrar, the routing application, the mediation server, and the appliance also comes with a gateway, obviously, right? You just want one box that does it all for you. So that's essentially what it is. Okay, so I can open up for a couple of questions. Yes. Can you come up to the mic? I can't quite... Here?
To the medium side.
This is the single data center.
Oh, yeah.
That one.
Oh, it's the monitoring. Okay, I couldn't read it. I was curious when you would separate mediation servers into its own pool, but that says monitoring.
That's a monitoring pool. Okay, so typically you would need a separate mediation server when you have SIP trunk.
Okay. In any case, would you separate mediation servers into their own pools?
We'll come to that. I'll address that, actually. I'll tell you exactly when that might be needed. But generally speaking, SIP trunk is when you're needed. Oh, yes.
High availability and scaling those mediation
server pools, when would we need it? Okay, so I don't have a separate slide for that, but I can tell you when you define routes, you can have different levels of routes. So you can order the routes that a particular call needs to go to. So from that perspective, a mediation server pool is considered as a single entity, right? So even if one of the mediation server goes down, there's still other mediation server that's going to take you. So that is one level of resiliency. The other level is, let's say none of the mediation servers are available, you can also define alternate routes for each of the routing rules.
So you can have multiple routes so that if the first one fails because the mediation server is down, you can try the next one.
Okay, great. So now to the exciting, oh, yes. So there are various queues that's supported for SBAs. So starting from 50 users all the way up to 1,000 users. So depending on the size of your branch office.
One more question?
Okay.
How many users before you make a direct pool? You will only have 4,000 or 5,000 users.
Okay.
Would you still use a direct pool or just let the front end server find the right?
If it's 4,000 or 5,000, I would suggest not. I mean, I don't think it warrants a director at this point in time. But and again, it all depends on if you scale out and then how loaded your front-end and front-end pools are. So from your case, it sounds like it's not going to be needed. Okay, so let's move on. IP PBX interoperability, the exciting part right here. So just to take a step back, from OCS 2007 R2, we did a really good job in making sure we actually interoperated with a bunch of other IP PBX, right? And I can make a statement saying, you know, we are probably the most interop-friendly system among what's available. And that's a pretty strong statement. The reason why we say that and why we actually believe in it is because in a lot of ways, Link is sort of like the new kid in the block, right? And we have to be competing with all the existing PBX systems, which means that for us to gain credibility and for us to be able to coexist with other system, we have to ensure that we interop with others. And that was the primary driver why fundamentally interop was a design principle from our perspective.
And so Microsoft calls it Direct SIP, right?
Yes.
That's what it's called, okay.
Yeah. So for folks that are not familiar with the term Direct SIP, what it is every PBX system has this Avaya SIP and there is this Cisco SIP, and potentially people can call it Link SIP, right? And a Direct SIP is really it's kind of a standardization. I shouldn't call it standardization, but the version of a SIP that everybody understands. So it ceases to be a Cisco SIP or ceases to be a Link SIP or ceases to be a BIOS SIP. It's just SIP that everybody understands. And that's what we mean by Direct SIP. Now, what were the limitations of what we offered in R2? The main thing was any time we had to interop with another system, we needed the mediation server entity to be in the middle. This was needed even for the control path and as well as for the media to be transcoded. So it always was in the middle. And then I have a slide to kind of showcase how that actually worked. So if the mediation server was being deployed in the central side and if all the media transactions happened in the central side or the regional, the bigger locations, it wasn't so much of a problem because you're always going to have administrators taking care of the servers. No problem, right? And the bandwidth typically is not a problem. Mm-hmm. However, it does become a big issue in smaller locations because two problems, right? You have to manage all these servers in the remote location, and it's money. It's anytime you have a requirement for extra servers, it's additional cost.
So you're saying that we'll have to deploy mediation servers in the branch offices then? Because of this limitation, I guess?
The limitation is really the last point, right? The media tromboning. What that means is you can say, I want to manage it easily, but I'm going to put it in the regional office. But what that's going to do is the media is going to basically go from the branch location to the central site and then come back because it's translated. And the other end is going to talk to the PBX systems. So it's not the most efficient use of the money, right? Or the resource from that perspective.
Your bandwidth, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. And this is kind of an example of what I'm talking about right here. So let's say the OCS pool this is kind of in the central site. And even if the mediation server, they all happen to be in the central side, so what that actually meant was the media from the OCS endpoint will have to flow through the mediation server, and the mediation server relays after transcoding it to the IP PBX system right here. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So in order to solve that, we introduce what's called as the media bypass. Right? So what does it actually do? Just to give you a quick analogy, so what used to happen in R2 was just think of the mediation server as a middleman. And the middleman's always saying, you know, I'm going to be here, I'm super expensive, but I need you, you need me, because let's say you're trying to do desperately a business transaction with your business partner, but the business partner talks a different language altogether. But you need the middleman. He's expensive. You can't afford the middleman in all the business locations, so you put him in your headquarters. If you put them in the headquarters, you have to hail a cab, go to the headquarters, have that translated to whatever your business partner understand, hail a cab back again, and then go to the same location. So that kind of translates to the bandwidth utilization. And if the business transaction has to happen quickly, cab going back and forth is nothing but your latency, right? And if you have this middleman in each one of your locations, that translates to additional resource requirement from a server perspective.
So it's a tax. So if you have your mediation server at the headquarters and you have these PBXs in each of the branches, the call leg is always going to go through the WAN link to the mediation server for transcoding and then back.
Correct.
As opposed to directly.
Okay, exactly. So in a perfect world, you want to get rid of the middleman that's actually causing a big tax from a latency perspective, from a server requirement perspective, and also from a bandwidth perspective, right? And that's exactly what media bypass does. It removes the need for media transit. And what it is it's a B2B. So the mediation server still continues to be a back-to-back server, but only for the control path. And if the IP PBX endpoint and the link endpoint happen to be in the same location, mediation server is just going to stay out of the picture. And the media just flows directly. So good.
So the signaling still goes through the mediation server,
yes,
but not the
The
media
signaling path. Still goes through the mediation server, the reason being we still want to be in the control path for security reason and we also for the audit reasons, right? If the session for, if the SIP dialogue for some reason is broken, we have our own mechanism to track that. We have to be able to track it in the call detail record. We still want to be in the control path just so we have transactions of all the sessions that's going on. Two things to remember for media bypass. The endpoints have to be local. They have to be in the same location. As long as they're in the same location, you bypass it. And then we'll look at how that is pulled off. If they're not local, then we do not bypass. And there is a reason for that, and I'll talk about why we don't. It's not a smart thing to bypass when the endpoints are not in the same location. Link, talking to a PBX, not in the same location, don't bypass. Okay, and this is what it looks like, right? As you can see, the control path in this particular case, SIP would still flow through the link and the mediation server, and the media is just basically going to flow directly to the PBX. I'm glad you asked. That's what
this
slide is going to talk about. So just to repeat the question, so how does it know if the endpoints are local to one another, right? So there are two settings. So there are two ways that you can utilize that. One is always bypass, so which means that you're always assuming that everything is local. So there are two situations when you would assume that, right? One is everything is really local. Physically, everything is local. So just say always bypass. Great. I do not want the mediation server to be in the middle. Just go for it. The second reason why you could think is my network is so great, my WAN links are so redundant and so rich in bandwidth that I really don't care, and I really don't worry about the bandwidth availability. And I always want to make sure mediation server is not in the middle. I let the link endpoint talk to the IP PBX directly. So this is when your network is bulletproof. Great. But that is not the case in pretty much most of the time. In some cases, it might be. So the second option is to actually determine with intelligence whether the endpoints are in the same location or not. And this is where we leverage network configuration settings. Network configuration setting is a representation of your network, and it defines your network hub and all the various branch office sites. So we call it the network sites and the network hub. And when this configuration itself is being set, the system automatically assigns bandwidth, what's called as the bypass ID, to each of these locations, right? And when the client signs in, based on its network location, it's assigned a bypass ID.
So it's based off its IP subnet.
Yes, it is based off of its IP subnet. And similarly, when the mediation server configures its next hop gateway could be a PBX as well, it knows exactly what the media bypass ID is going to be because it's configured, it fetches it from the network configuration setting. And to answer your question, with those two information during the call itself when it's being established, the mediation server, we look at when the mediation server makes the decision and when the link client endpoint makes the decision. But essentially, that's how it determines.
And so they compare the two, and then if there's a match?
Correct. So if the bypass ID that's assigned to the gateway or the IP PBX is the same as that of the link endpoint, great. That means they're in the same location.
And so media bypass?
It'll be bypassed.
Great.
Yes. And one other caveat, not really caveat, but something to remember is the call admission control and media bypass, always media bypass, doesn't go together because it's kind of an oxymoron, right? Call admission control fundamentally assumes that your network is not bulletproof and you want to have control over how the call itself is getting established. Always bypass is the opposite. And, you know, things are great. I really don't want any call admission control. So as you can see in this particular slide, if you enable call admission control, always bypass is disabled. You cannot do this. When you're worried about the network, you cannot do always bypass. All right. So how does it actually work? For the inbound, clearly the invite is originating from the PBX. The mediation server receives it, slaps in the bypass ID off the PBX because the mediation server already has mapped the bypass ID for it, and then passes it on to the link client. The link client already has its own bypass ID when it signed in, and when the invite is received, it compares its bypass ID with that of the IP PBX. If it's the same, then it actually responds to the SDP of SDP. For folks that are not familiar with SDP, it's Session Description Protocol, which is essentially a list of IP addresses that an entity can be reached at. So it chooses bypass in this particular case. If the bypass IDs don't match, then clearly it has to go through the mediation server. So is that clear? Okay. Outbound, it's kind of similar, but it happens in the opposite way, but more interesting here. Link passes its bypass ID. It hits the mediation server. Mediation server, before it forwards the invite to the PBX or the gateway, it determines the bypass ID and then compares it on the fly. If they match, then it's automatically going to use the SDP, as in the way to reach the link client directly to the PBX. So in which case, it's as if PBX thinks the mediation server doesn't really exist for media, and the media session establishes directly.
So it depends on where the call is inbound or outbound, who makes the decision, right?
That is correct.
If it's inbound, it's the client. If it's outbound, it's the mediation server.
Correct. So if it is inbound, it's the client has the final say because it receives the invite. Outbound is more interesting because the eventual invite lands on the PBX, but mediation server is able to make a decision even before the invite is sent over to the PBX. Excuse me. So this is for your reference. I'm not going to talk through this, but it contains a list of SBAs, gateways, and IP PBX systems that we have tested and certified for bypass. And then you might want to visit the open interoperability page.
Yeah, the OIP page that's available on the web. If you just do a quick search of open interoperability program and then put link, and you'll find its first result in your favorite search engine. Just go there, and you'll be able to find all the supported gateways and PBXs that interop with Link. And that page stays up to date in terms of new partners that are supported.
Yep. Okay. So I'm going to quickly run through this. Hopefully, you've kind of grasped the fundamentals of it. One thing to point out is it doesn't matter how many sites you have. No problem. You can define media bypass for multiple sites. That's just going to take care of your bypass requirements accordingly. So the examples that we saw are it was pretty basic, right? But it does not matter. It can extend across of multiple sites. As long as the endpoint entities are in the same sites, they should basically be able to take care of it. And the way you want to approach that is to define regions and sites in the network configuration that, as we talked about, and define the media gateway in the topology builder. So the media gateway in this particular case would be, so we're going to quickly look at Cisco, how we actually deal with Cisco from a media bypass perspective, okay. But you want to treat that as a virtual media gateway. And you can configure that in the topology builder. And associate the media IP to each of the gateway. Now, obviously, that's one of the configuration. You've got to be able to associate the IP address itself in the topology builder. And the listening port, of course, that's pretty obvious. You still have to configure that. Now, the last point is about setting up routes, but that is kind of independent of media bypass or not. You have to set up the right route anyway. But the critical point here is to be able to map your region and site information to the IP address. Okay. And the configuring the IP address is what's
now, is there a tool to do that? How do you go about doing that? Is that something simple, something that would just automatically just do that? Or do you have to like manually go and identify all the subnets? And
yeah, so the initial configuration of the subnets, there are sample scripts that's available because obviously it's we don't want to make it too manual, right? So the first step, the recommendation is always to do scripting, and there are sample scripts on how to do it. But once you're done it, so this is a good example of a screenshot. As you can see, the control panel has that mapping, whatever you have scripted, and then put it in the CMS. And it contains a complete mapping of all your region sites and the location policy stuff that you do for enhanced 911, the regional links, and all the stuff that's related to network configuration. It can be edited and then viewed through the
control panel.
So this
is where you specify a site, and you can identify the subnets at the bottom
exactly,
over there.
Exactly. So what you see right here is... that's not bad.
Well, that rain sounds like it's coming down really heavy. We're going to be really wet for the party.
Yeah, so this is the configuration of your virtual gateway. So that's the PBX. And these are the alternate media IP address. And that's what's going to be used to associate every entity to a site. So in this particular case, the fact that this subnet is configured for HQ, the headquarters, which means during when the call itself is being placed, the IP address would be mapped to this particular subnet and hence to that particular site, and every site is associated with a bypass ID.
That's right.
Okay, so quickly, getting real into this particular example would be, let's say you have a branch office, Orlando branch, of course, right? There is a link client endpoint, and the branch office also has an ISR router with MTP enabled. So the system itself can be configured to have the control path flow from link to the Cisco call manager, where, again, the recommendation is to have MTP enabled should you actually communicate with an endpoint that's in the headquarters in this particular, not in this case, but the coming case. But if the endpoint is in the headquarters, that's where the MTP is going to be used.
Now, what is MTP?
MTP is media termination point. So
that's where the connection terminates.
Yes.
Okay.
And in this particular example, as you can see, the control path in red flows from the link endpoint to the link to the Cisco call manager and back to the ISRs, right? However, with media bypass enabled, the media is directly going to flow from the link endpoint directly to the ISR and hence to the Cisco phone.
And that's what the G711 is, right?
Yeah, so the biggest, and again, so we now speak a common language, right? Because with the media bypass, the biggest advantage here is going to be there is no transcoding that's going to be required. If we did not do bypass, what's going to happen is link endpoint is going to talk RT audio, and then that's going to be transcoded to G711, and then that talks to the ISR.
ISR.
And then, of course, if there's more transcoding, we don't want to deal with that, right?
Right.
So essentially, this is the biggest advantage. There is no transcoding. It's just boom. It's local, and G711, obviously, it's a pretty bandwidth-heavy codec, but it doesn't matter because it's all in the local network. And great. Even if the WAN goes down after the call is established, the session's still going to exist.
So that's for an existing call, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what if the WAN was down and you want to establish a new call?
Okay.
What happens there?
So what would you folks do? So let's say, what is the solution for that? SBA, exactly. So that's Yeah, so this slide, if you have an SBA, no problem. So you're still going to be able to survive. So even if the call wasn't established, no problem. You're still able to talk to all these Cisco users in the branch office.
So that's the main advantage of the SBA.
That is correct. So again, it always guarantees that the voice communication is available. Whether it's to another PBX system or it's through PSTN, you're always connected. So media bypass, this is the case when the media bypass is not going to happen, right? And this is where I'm going to explain why it's not a good idea to not to do media bypass all the time, right? So let's take an example right here where an Orlando branch user is making a call to a headquarters site user who's a Cisco user. And in this particular case, clearly, the endpoint, the media endpoint itself is going to be in the headquarters. And the MTP configured here is also in the headquarters. Now, by our logic, clearly, it's not going to bypass because the bypass ID that's provided to Orlando is different from that one that's available in the headquarters, right? So no bypass. Let's say if we did bypass, the media would have flown from the link client to the Cisco call manager MTP right here. Right here. So this would have happened. However, we do not want that to happen. Do you guys know why? Exactly. So we don't want, so the answer was it would have used G711. And as you know, it's so bandwidth heavy that we do not want it to traverse the WAN link, especially if it's flaky. And that would be a pretty bad thing from two perspectives. One is the bandwidth utilization, and also going through the mediation server provides media healing. So mediation server can actually do a lot more sophisticated things and then sort of, you know, patch up, be able to deal with packet loss and latency and things of that nature. And this is where the transcoding is going to happen. So in this particular case, your media path is going to be, yes, I mean, obviously it's right here.
And so it'll go from the link client to the mediation server's RT audio and then get translated.
That is correct. That is correct. So if you were to create a cheat sheet for the coexistence and migration, this is our recommendation. So define the topology with Cisco Call Manager and yes. On the second branch, let's see. Yeah, in that case, it won't bypass. Right? So the link endpoint is in one branch, and the link, the Cisco phone is another branch.
You know, I would recommend maybe coming afterwards and asking the question because we're just kind of out of time. I want to make sure
I think we should cover that. But
it's a good question. If you want to come back,
we can
and
work
ask
that
the
out.
Question.
Yeah. So define the topology with Cisco Call Manager and ISR in the topology. And obviously, the ISRs in the branch cases is going to be used as a bridge between your link topology and the Cisco topology. And clearly, you have to configure ISR for media bypass. So the screenshot that we saw where you would configure the alternate IP address, and that IP address translate sort of maps to a site subnet. That's what we're talking about here. And direct SIP between a Cisco call manager and link. And this could also be configured to do extension-based dialing. So if you have branch users want to basically talk to one another, yes, absolutely. And clearly for Cisco call manager also, you want to enable MTP, bypass as well. The simple reason being, let's say Alice is an Orlando user. She typically places a call to a Cisco user in headquarters. Here's a cool thing. If Alice travels to headquarters and places a call to the same headquarters Cisco user, guess what's going to happen? Is the call going to be bypassed or not? The answer is yes, because the bypass is dynamic, right? So it does take into consideration on where the currently where the endpoint is currently located.
And there are white papers that Microsoft produces on how to configure direct SIP between call manager and link. So please refer to those.
Yep. And migrate users stepwise. and virtually no additional hardware required. Isn't that great? I'm going to skip this. The point the slide is basically making is, irrespective of how complex your current topology is, you can always do it incrementally. So you can go from the left portion to the right portion where, as you can see, there is site one that was originally enabled, and then you can actually keep extending over to other sites as well. So takeaways, yes, you want to sort of natively integrate with other PBX, and that's going to clearly allow low-cost proof of concepts, being able to connect migrated and non-migrated users of Link. In fact, that could be used as a long-term coexistence as well. If the initial investment is large enough, you want to protect it. Great. So native integration with Media Bypass enables CPE-less deployment. What that is a customer premise equipment. That is the point that deals with no additional hardware really required in that particular case. And for keeping all of the media traffic local to your location, you don't want unnecessary traversal through WAN links. And yes, it's absolutely possible. Okay. So I'm going to quickly jump into the video strategy and the video interoperability. So there's three prong approaches to video interop and video offering by Link. So one is to embrace and lead interoperability. And needless to say, it's kind of a similar approach with voice as well. We want to coexist with as many systems as possible. The second is to improve the meeting experience because it deals directly with the productivity. And we're always trying to improve on that. And finally, high-quality desktop video. And we believe this is where the future is. It's almost like democratization of videos, if you will. But for the sake of this session, we will focus just on video interoperability, right? And to that point, there are two approaches. One is to optimize your video experience for the desktop video, and then we have our own logo programs that that kind of certifies your IP devices, which fundamentally registers into the network, and then it's a video device. PCs, we certify PCs as well with embedded cameras. And webcams, clearly. But the interesting part is, how do we deal with third-party video VTC systems, right? So there are two approaches to it. One is directly register into the Link system, which means that it does look like a native Link endpoint. The other one is use a gateway. If you already have an existing video system, use a gateway, and then that way they can interop with one another. And there is a qualification program, and there are white papers and list of partners that are certified already available through our OIP page. Requirements for OCSR2, what we require from the partners, are they got to be, I mean, security is definitely important. At this point in time, we support for OCSR2, 2007 R2, it's point-to-point sessions, and we definitely need firewall traversal. So ICE is a necessity. If you look at Link 2010, it looks like the same, but it also supports RT video high definition, and we also are able to support multi-party video. So conference is supported. That's fantastic.
And so that's your list of partners
that's the list of the partners. And just to go through a quick a summary of the differences between the two approaches. One is direct registration. The other one is the gateway approach. The first one, yeah, clearly. The direct registration registers directly. It looks like a Link endpoint. The other one does not. It goes through a gateway. Do they both support multi-party? Yes, they do. The difference being the direct registration would be joining the ABMCU, the Link component. When it comes to conference, the other one would be using the media control unit of, it's a hardware media control unit of our third party. And that would interop with one another using the gateway. They both appear as contacts, so that's a good seamless experience. But there are some niceties that you get with native registration in the form of when you right-click, you kind of get more information about the endpoint and some rich information that you're not going to get through the gateway approach. And bottom, I mean, you see the list of partners that are currently signed up. For the direct registration, we are Can you hold on to that when you get to the Q&A? We'll get to that. A Polycom life size, and for the gateway approach, we have Polycom life size and RAD vision. And then finally, how many of you folks are interested in the telepresence? Okay, great. So we keep hearing this question about, is telepresence really supported? At this point in time, we do not have an official support for telepresence yet. For OCS 2007 R2, there is a way to do it. For Link, I mean, there hasn't been, any announcement or there hasn't been any progress in that front. However, one possible solution for OCS 2007 R2 is by using VCS gateway for signaling, and there are some advanced media gateways to do HD video. So essentially, you need these two components to perform HD videos. If firewall traversal is important to you, then you need two additional VCS gateways to pull that off. However, at this point in time, the recommendation is really to stick with our certified partner, certified partners, the two approaches that we have actually taken. So
Alexa, it's finished. Got it done.
Wow, 20 seconds to go. Isn't that cool? But yes, we are open to questions, and I'm definitely happy to take questions. And where's the...
And thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time, and please fill the eval. I hope this session was useful for you, but definitely Rui and I are going to stick around to take your questions.